From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
PFC Bradley Manning, National Security and Blowing the Whistle. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Did Bradley Manning aid the enemy with the biggest classified document dump in American history? A military judge today said he did not. He was found guilty on 5 charges of espionage in a case that's making legal history in the era of information technology. How much damage did Manning do? How are his revelations different from Edward Snowden's? How will today's verdict affect the future release of government secrets in the interests of the people's right to know? Today's talking point, tweeting about a mother's death from the ICU. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. After PFC Bradley Manning confessed to releasing 700,000 classified documents, he was charged with aiding the enemy. Today, a military court judge found him not guilty of that crime, but guilty of espionage. What are the consequences for Bradley Manning, for government secrecy, and for investigative reporting? Today's talking point, NPR's weekend edition host Scott Simon touched a chord beyond his own followers when he tweeted about his mother as she was dying in a hospital. Are social media platforms making it easier to confront the inevitable? First, this news update. President Obama and Vice President Biden met today with negotiators for Israel and the Palestinians. Secretary of State John Kerry says they have agreed to tackle all of the so-called final status issues.
I think reasonable compromises has to be a keystone of all of this effort. I know the negotiations are going to be tough, but I also know that the consequences of not trying could be worse.
Ann Guerin is diplomacy correspondent for The Washington Post. As always, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to do it.
There are those who are warning that trying and failing could, in fact, make things worse. How risky is this?
Well, the risk is that it's always gone off the rails before, and so trying it again carries an ever heavier burden of the past each time you try it. And Kerry addressed that head on today with the Palestinian and Israeli negotiators standing at his sides at the State Department. He said, "We know that there's skepticism, and we know that this same effort has gone wrong before." But the consequences of not doing it are worse, so you have to try. And both the Israeli and the Palestinian lead negotiators who came to Washington for this sort of formal ringing of the bell said versions of the same thing, that it is everyone's duty and in everyone's interest to try. But they all know what a very, very hard road is ahead.
We heard Kerry say that reasonable compromises have to be the keystone of all of this. Have there been any evidence of any specific reasonable compromises recently?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a fairly major one over the weekend when the Israeli cabinet voted to release some long-held Palestinian prisoners. This had been a condition of talks. At least some prisoner release, if not all of them, had been a condition of talks for the Palestinians for a long time. And the Israelis had insisted, with U.S. backing, that there would be no such conditions. That if talks were to resume, they would resume as they are, without anyone having to give anything up ahead of time, and that you should only negotiate those issues once you are negotiating. Well, in the end, the Israelis agreed to release 104 Palestinian prisoners, including some with Israeli blood on their hands, as a concession, if you will, a confidence building measure, a way to pave the talks for the Palestinians. The Palestinians also run a political risk simply by agreeing to show up. The confidence among Palestinians that the Israelis will bargain in good faith and that these talks can really produce something is so low that whatever you think of the value of negotiating for the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, to agree to these talks at all, it really puts him at political risk at home.
What about the nine-month deadline that the Secretary of State set?
Yes, well, of course, the State Department insists it's not a deadline, it's just a goal. But it is a deadline, because what Kerry wants here is to get things off to a fast start and to keep them going. I does not want to get into these interminable talks that, while not so much on the Mideast front, have certainly been a hallmark of international diplomacy before, where you just, you know, you negotiate endlessly and have another, at each meeting you agree to have another meeting and really nothing is resolved. He wants the framework for these agreements to be clear from the start, and for there to be, if not an official deadline, then an unofficial one, so that everybody knows that really by early to mid next year, they ought to have this done, or they ought to be able to say that they're not going to.
With all that is going on in Syria, in Egypt, in Iraq now as well, are there those who are saying that the Secretary of State may be taking his eye off the ball, or does it work the other way? Is this something that could affect all of those difficult situations?
Well, there are two ways to answer that. It certainly, by the amount of time it took Kerry, of his time, and the personal investment that was required here, he ran the risk of looking as though he was looking past or slighting the more imminent crises, starting with the Middle East and, you know, in Egypt and Syria right next door, right? You've got things that are happening now, falling apart now. Why are you spending your time on this sort of elusive goal that, you know, might get you a Nobel Peace Prize, but it ain't what's happening right this minute? He knew that. But the other way to look at it is that the United States doesn't have a lot of leverage in either the Syria or Egypt situations. There isn't a lot that the Secretaries of State's personal involvement and direct diplomacy can do to change either of those situations. So he would argue that he was putting his time and effort into the thing that the United States has not only a great stake, but also the greatest possibility to affect.
And very quickly, if you can, where will they be meeting?
Well, the next meeting will be either in Israel or in the West Bank, and most meetings will be there. The next meeting will be within 2 weeks, and we don't know at this point whether there will be a U.S. representative.
Ann Guerin with the Washington Post, as always, many thanks to you.
Thank you.
In a moment, Bradley Manning, not guilty on the most serious charge, but guilty on others. We'll get the details on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. The verdicts are in. Army Colonel Denise Lind, the judge in Bradley Manning's court-martial, ruled today that Manning did not aid the enemy when he gave 700,000 classified documents to WikiLeaks while he was an intelligence analyst stationed in Iraq. But he was found guilty of other very serious charges. Greg Mitchell blogs for The Nation magazine. He's co-author of the book Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. Good. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to talk to you again, Warren.
So we know that the aid the enemy charge did carry the possibility of a life term in prison. What about the other charges he was found guilty of?
Yes, I believe the count is 19. Some of them he pleaded guilty to himself quite some time ago, but there were many other charges that he's been found guilty of today, and as you mentioned, they are quite serious. They involve charges of espionage, of releasing information improperly, of I believe one is called computer fraud, but it all involves leaking classified or secret or sensitive documents and two videos to WikiLeaks, hundreds of thousands of documents, and to refresh people's memory, they were related to the Iraq War, to the Afghanistan War, to Gitmo, and what was known as Cablegate, diplomatic cables from abroad, and they all had tremendous, and in the view of some very positive effects. And the serious charge of aiding the enemy was the one that would quite possibly lead to life in prison, but the accumulation of the other 19 charges could add up to 130 years in prison. So, you know, he still faces a lot of trouble, and the sentencing arguments begin tomorrow.
They begin that soon. Was this a case, as far as aiding the enemy is concerned, of reasonable doubt? Does that same standard exist in the military cases?
Yeah, I think that the question with that, the reason there was so much focus on that was one, because it had the stiffest sentence. Two, it had, you know, kind of the worst connotations for Manning, you know, close to being a traitor, you know, aiding the enemy. I mean, what can be worse than that?
Yeah.
But it also had severe potential ramifications for journalists and for would-be whistleblowers, because unlike, you know, previously aiding the enemy, you'd have to sort of say you deliberately wanted to aid the enemy, as opposed to a journalist or a whistleblower who, in good faith, writes an article, publishes something, does a video, leaks information to the press that could be very important and valuable, but could be construed as somehow helping some enemy abroad. And so you would be slapped with that very, very serious charge, even though it was far from your intention and you were just looking out for the public interest.
Once again, there was nothing precise about the way that this was done, 700,000 documents. There's no way in the world he could have read them all. And also videos as well. Tell us, if you will, a little more about exactly what was released, and particularly the cables and the videos.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing that got the most attention, and you know, and you mentioned my book Truth and Consequences, it goes back to the beginning and traces Manning from when he went in the military to those early releases right up to the current trial. And you know, as I show in the book, the very first thing that got publicity and really brought WikiLeaks to public attention in a big way was the so-called collateral murder video that of course showed the U.S. Copters firing on civilians and two Reuters employees on the ground in Iraq, and sort of laughing about it. And you know, that was released was the very first thing. But then the rest of that year, just 2 or 3 years ago now, you had the flood of, in separate releases, documents related to our involvement in Iraq, then Afghanistan. And then at the end of that year, the diplomatic cables. And, you know, you really don't have enough time to talk about all the ramifications, but it ranged from, you know, people in the U.S. seeing the scope of our activities in the war zones and the possible torture, corruption, civilian casualties, and so forth. And then with the cables, our relations with so many countries abroad, and things really not so much about that made us look bad, so much as revealed very valuable things about what was going on in some of these places, including Egypt, which helped lead to the protests there, at Tunisia, which some people have said really sparked the overthrow of the government there, Syria, and just you could list 60 countries around the world. So incredibly far-reaching, and what some people may forget now is that WikiLeaks did post these things over time, but their collaborators were the New York Times, was the Guardian, and dozens of other leading newspapers. So it wasn't just like Julian Assange was out there, you know, posting these on the little WikiLeaks site, and the New York Times and the Guardian was publishing them very, very widely.
Julian Assange, of course, the man who leads WikiLeaks, the anti-secrecy group. He has been holed up in an embassy in Britain for a long time. Here is what Julian Assange has to say about Bradley Manning.
We call those types of people that are willing to risk, not be a martyr, but to risk being a martyr for all the rest of us. We call those people heroes. Bradley Manning is a hero.
Elizabeth Goitein is top national security lawyer at New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Is Bradley Manning any kind of hero?
Not in my eyes. I think that he, you know, as you said, just didn't have time to read all of the documents that he disclosed. And so, you know, to me, what he did was quite reckless. But I also don't think he's a traitor. And part of the problem is that our laws, and especially the way that our government is applying our laws, just fail to take into account, first of all, the difference between a hero and a traitor, and second, all the shades of gray in between, because there are disclosures of classified information that are treasonous, and then there are disclosures that are reckless or negligent or a result of confusion or poor judgment. And then you have actual whistleblowers who find improperly classified evidence of misconduct and who lack any sort of safe or legal way to bring it to light. So it's a much more complex story than really any of the sides on this case are making it sound like.
Was Bradley Manning protected in a way because WikiLeaks did, in fact, use legitimate sources of news and information to let the material out?
I don't think that that was legally significant. I don't think that provided him with any sort of legal protection under the law for both aiding the enemy and for, and under the Espionage Act charges and some of the other charges, the defense that he or that the organizations that he worked with, you know, were being careful, that would not have been a defense. And I think it would have been, there was an expert witness who testified about the care that WikiLeaks took with some of its documents, but I still think it might have been a tough sell.
And obviously it was WikiLeaks, not Bradley Manning, that was taking care. What about the espionage violations? How serious are they?
They're very serious. I mean, the name of the statute kind of says it all. The Espionage Act was enacted during World War I, and it was enacted to deal with traitors and with spies. All of these charges, when you add them together, he could very well be spending the rest of his life in prison. And I think it's a very, very significant precedent to have this conviction with the potential of such serious prison time for a disclosure of information to the media that was not, intended really to aid the enemy or to harm the United States, because that traditionally is not what the Espionage Act has been used for. So I think it is a significant precedent.
So you're saying he was overcharged?
I believe he was overcharged, and I think that there's been a pattern of overcharging people who leak information to the media by this administration, that the Espionage Act has been used in a way it was never intended to go after people who intended no harm to the United States. Now, that doesn't mean that all of these people should get off scot-free. It doesn't mean they all deserve a medal. I think, the circumstances are very different in each case. But there's a lot you can do in between giving somebody a medal and charging them under the Espionage Act. And there are administrative penalties, there are even lesser criminal charges that could have been brought that were not brought. So, it really is something we have to look at very carefully. How do we handle national security leaks in this country?
Elizabeth Guiteen at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. David Rifkin's a Washington attorney. He's an expert on national security law, served in the Department of Justice and in the White House during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. David Rifkin, welcome back to our program.
Good to see you, Warren.
Do you think that Bradley Manning was overcharged?
I do not. I actually think that their grounds to at least try to prevail for the government on aiding the enemy charge. And let me say this, the very fact that this individual leaked everything in his possession without any selectivity, without any effort to discover if he was, a general whistleblower, what's wrong, what's right. He's done it in time of war. He's done it knowing full well that WikiLeaks would indiscriminately publish everything, and of course it would be available to the enemy. Suggests to me he was not overcharged. Now, what saved him, frankly, is that the Article 104 of UCMJ, which deals with this particular charge, requires that you give it directly to the enemy. Give what? The intelligence information. That was true. Since WikiLeaks, by definition, is not the enemy, the government had to prove that he did it by indirect means, and actually it had specific intent to aid the enemy. And that's not easy to prove, so Colonel Lynn threw this charge out. But, I mean, look, people like him and, frankly, like Edward Snowden, I think at least at the common sense level, manifest an utter disdain for this country. And it's not good enough to say, well, we love American people, we don't like the government, because we're a democracy, the government reflects the people. So the very totality of their behavior, to me, is a very powerful evidence. We're not talking about some disgruntled DOD employee or State Department employee who went and talked to, you know, James Rosen or AP reporter about a particular event he feels is wrong, a particular policy he feels is wrong.
Is disdain for the country a crime?
No, well, it goes to his, you can exercise your First Amendment right and manifest disdain for the United States plenty of times. But if you, in addition to manifesting disdain, release massive quantities of classified information that you were duty-bound to protect, I don't have any sympathy for that person. Again, we have numerous opportunities where people who disagree with a totality of our country's policies can do that. He could have become a blogger. He could have become a pundit. He could have been a demonstrator. He could have become, there are real whistleblowers in this town, or as you know too well. They must be insulted by that. That's not what you do as a whistleblower. You first go for the channels. This guy, I mean, these are little people with highly inflated egos. The notion that either Mr. Snowden or Mr. Manning are whistleblowers is absurd. I mean, we're not talking about some mid-level government official who, after decades in government, believes that our policy on, you know, Middle Eastern peace process is not cool, and try to convince their superiors for years, and then eventually go to Congress or something. These are real whistleblowers. These people are not.
Let me go back to Elizabeth Goitein. Now, you're concerned about what the impact might be on whistleblowers in the future because of the way this case has been dealt with. Elaborate a bit on that.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the judge's ruling from this case did not say, you know, if Bradley Manning had been around in government for a few decades, which I'm not quite sure what difference that makes, but let's, you know, going off of what Mr. Rifkin said, if Bradley Manning had been in government for several decades and had gone through other channels and, you know, had only disclosed, you know, 20 documents instead of 700,000, then I'd be dropping these charges. That's not what she said. She said that, in fact, you know, his intent didn't matter, his subjective motive didn't matter, and that all that mattered under the Espionage Act charges is that he disclosed classified information that he had reason to believe could harm national security. Now, that part of it ought to be some protection, but I think that can be a very subjective test. So I think that is still going to have a very chilling effect on actual whistleblowers. And as I said before, I'm not in the camp of people who thinks that Bradley Manning, you know, is a whistleblower 100%, because I don't think he read all the documents. But there are people who will be affected by the rulings and the verdict in this case, who really do qualify as whistleblowers and who really ought to have more legal protections than they do.
Back to Greg Mitchell, author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. Is Bradley Manning a person who is disdainful of his country?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, you could, if you really oppose what he did, you could read into what he did and claim that. But, you know, he is someone who joined the military in times of war, went to Iraq, and you know, of course, the great debate at the trial was what were his motivations? Was he just disgruntled, had personal issues, and so on and so forth, or was he more idealistic and he really wanted to bring information to the public, which they deserve to know? And, you know, in fact, so much of what was released turned out to be incredibly valuable. And we, again, with Edward Snowden, many, many critics of Edward Snowden, of course. However, the releases that he made have provoked a much overdue debate in this country, congressional action, media focus, on subjects of secrecy and you know, spying on Americans that had been swept under the rug.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a break on Talking Point later, tweeting about a mother's death from the ICU. Back in a moment with this conversation on To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren, I'll be back with To the Point, talking today about Bradley Manning, PFC. Was he disgruntled? Was he idealistic when he released 700,000 classified documents to WikiLeaks, along with cables and videos as well? Found not guilty today of aiding the enemy, but guilty of several very serious espionage charges, which could get him a very, very long term in prison. A moment ago, David Rifkin, who served with the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, said that any real whistleblower would be insulted by what Bradley Manning has done. Jesselyn Radick is Director of National Security and Human Rights at the Government Accountability Project, which is a whistleblowing advocacy organization. She herself was a whistleblower fired by the Justice Department for releasing information. Jesselyn Radick, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Are you insulted by Bradley Manning?
Absolutely not. And in fact, I have represented two of the whistleblowers who've been prosecuted under the Espionage Act as part of President Obama's crackdown on whistleblowers, both Thomas Drake and John Kiriakou, and both of them support Bradley Manning 100%, as do I. I find this disdain for people like him and Snowden. Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden will go down in history positively, and this is going to look horrible. I mean, obviously, using the Espionage Act is complete overcharging of people who allegedly mishandled, allegedly classified information. And this is, in fact, the first time out of this whole parade of leak investigations and prosecutions that the government has secured a conviction, because the case against Tom Drake fell apart completely, and John Kiriakou was convicted on one count that had nothing to do with espionage. So as a whistleblower and as an attorney who represents hundreds of whistleblowers, none of them condemn what Manning did. Most of them stand shoulder to shoulder with him and with Edward Snowden. I think names like hero or traitor or, you know, are kind of reckless, but whistleblower, there's a pretty straightforward definition: someone who disclosed fraud, waste, abuse, illegality, or danger to public health and safety. And the fact of the matter is that Bradley Manning exposed war crimes, torture, kidnapping. Those crimes were never charged. So if you look at Bradley Manning and the sentence today, even though the completely out-of-hand aiding the enemy charge was not upheld, espionage is an incredibly serious charge meant to go after spies, not whistleblowers. And clearly, Bradley Manning was not out trying to spy on the United States or benefit a foreign nation.
David Rifkin, back to you. War crimes, torture, kidnapping. Shouldn't the American public know about those things?
Well, first of all, I disagree with his characterization of our conduct in this war. Whatever you think about the Iraq War and Afghanistan War, U.S. has waged those wars in most scrupulous compliance with the laws of war, far more so than any other war in human history. But leaving that aside, the very characterization of a person who basically indiscriminately, promiscuously got a hold of everything he could get a hold of and dumped it, gave it to WikiLeaks, suggests that my colleague is totally wrong. I mean, again, you call somebody a whistleblower, this person, and maybe I'm wrong about spending many years in government, but with some reasonable element of analysis, concludes that a given American policy is wrong, tries to change it for legitimate means, which I think everybody would agree, fails, and then takes the extraordinary step of going to a reporter or going to Congress. Did Mr. Snowden or did Mr. Manning think that every diplomatic cable in Mr. Manning's case that he could disclose and harm greatly our relations and endangered with dozens of countries, made us a laughingstock and endangered lots of people's lives? Did he think there was fraud, waste, and mismanagement and torture and war crimes there? No. I mean, and who appointed these people? God. I mean, they're basically saying the entire totality of our foreign and defense policy is so utterly illegitimate, is so utterly rotten, that they can just sweep it all in the open, that no other country has done that, and that provokes debates. I cannot tell you how sick, frankly, this view makes me.
Jesselyn Radick, how do you respond to that?
I respond to that mowing down innocent civilians, including Reuters reporters and children, as if you were playing the video game, Call of Duty, that is a war crime. I worked in the White House and the Justice Department also, and I'm an attorney representing whistleblowers. In terms of going through channels, if any of these people on the show had actually bothered to go to trial, they would know that he did not indiscriminately turn over everything he had access to. In fact, he did only turned over the lowest level classification secret of documents he had access to, much higher level classified, that he did not turn over. In terms of going through channels, one need only look at my client Thomas Drake to know that going through channels will also, you would also end up in an Espionage Act prosecution for going through every proper channel suggested by Mr. Rifkin. And in terms of harm, the United States claimed great harm, but they never produced any damage assessments. So if these folks had actually attended the trial, they would know all of this. But again, they're speaking, with the usual stereotypes and smears that he took it into his hands to play God, whereas the law actually permits whistleblowers to make a reasonable decision that they viewed something illegal. And obviously, much of what he disclosed reveals illegalities.
Before we go any further, let me go back to Elizabeth Goyton at the Brennan Center for Justice. And is there a distinction to be made between what Bradley Manning did and what Edward Snowden did?
Well, I don't think we know enough, frankly, about what Edward Snowden did and how he did it to talk about sort of those distinctions. And I also think we don't know enough about their subjective motives either. I just want to get back to this point of, whether or not Bradley Manning is a whistleblower. I have great respect for Jesslyn, and I agree with her on about 99% of everything she ever says. But the definition of a whistleblower is not somebody who discloses a violation of law or fraud, waste, or abuse. It's somebody who discloses information who, quote, reasonably believes, end quote, that there's a violation of the law or waste or abuse. And that's where I get hung up, because I don't see how somebody can reasonably believe something about a document if they haven't read it. Now, that said, I absolutely believe from the evidence, which I followed very, very closely, as closely as I could, not being able to go to the trial because of all the NSA disclosures and having to deal with those, from the evidence, it seems quite clear to me that Bradley Manning had no intent to harm the nation, and that he thought that he was doing a public service, and he thought that in these documents that he disclosed, there was information that the American public had a right to know. And ultimately, I think he was correct. I think that the information that he disclosed, some of it was extremely important for the American public to know, and there has been no evidence of any kind of long-term or significant harm to the United States. Even the government's own assessments have found what they called pockets of short-term harm. So I just think, we need to be able to have a nuanced conversation about what happened here and about what's appropriate in these circumstances. And Mr. Rifkin said, who made Bradley Manning God? I mean, my question is, who made the officials who classify documents God? Who gave them the final word on whether information is actually harmful to the national security? We know that there is a massive overclassification problem in this country, massive. And I'm not making that up. That's not my assessment. That's the assessment of high-level officials from all administrations. And so right there, a person who is a whistleblower, who discloses information showing government misconduct that has been improperly classified, whatever else you can say about that person, they are not acting as a traitor, and they are doing their best to perform a public service.
David Rifkin, if the government said there were only pockets of short-term harm, where is the great damage that you talked about earlier?
Well, two things. First, I do not believe that there are pockets of harm. I think there's a long-term strategic consequence to manifesting, which is very difficult.
But the government didn't say that.
Well, again, we're having a conversation at the classified level about the consequences of things where all the facts are not clear to us. But if you expose in a massive way, forget the military secrets for a second, in a massive way, the totality of a large data stream of classified diplomatic cables, how do you measure the harm? But I can tell you this much. If I were a French diplomat, so if I were a Ghanaian diplomat, or if I were a Paraguayan diplomat, the next time I would be much less candid, much less willing to play ball with Americans given this, and that's going to endure for years. Now, again, if we live in a world where people think that openness, total transparency, with the United States being the only country to do that, is just dandy, then I cannot change these people's mind. But they may just spend 30 seconds answering who made him God, and what about people who classified information. In our republic, in our democracy, the rules promulgated by people's representatives are what drives things. There's nothing inherently sacred about the executive branch officials whose job it is to classify information, but they have legitimacy. They have popular consent for that. That's how democracy works. And people who don't understand that don't understand democracy at all. I'm sorry.
Jocelyn Raddick, how do you respond to that?
You know, I consider Liza one of the nation's experts in classification, and clearly things are overclassified as they were against my client, Tom Drake, who was also charged under the Espionage Act. Every single count, the information upon which it was based, was later determined to be completely unclassified. I'm not saying that that is the issue with Bradley Manning, but believe me, if there were long-term strategic harm coming out of this, the prosecution would have surely made the judge aware of it. And I think 136 years maximum punishment when the government leaks high-level sources and methods every day is completely out of whack. I agree, certain things should be legitimate secrets, nuclear design information, troop movements, etc. But when you're classifying war crimes, that is an improper, illegitimately classified piece of information.
Greg Mitchell, back to you. Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning, your book. Is it correct for Jocelyn Raddick to say that Manning could have released a great deal more information that had a higher level of classification than what he did release?
Well, that's undeniably true. He was somewhat selective. There's no question about it. And even leaking the WikiLeaks was also didn't dump everything out there. And finally, the major dissemination was through the New York Times, the Guardian, and all these other newspapers, which were highly, and in fact, in some cases, too highly selective. They held back a lot of things I think public should have known about. Other things they held back properly. So, and in fact, he called, as it emerged at the trial, he called the New York Times, he called the Washington Post in advance to try to get them to deal with his documents in some form before the WikiLeaks releases. And he got no response from the New York Times and the Washington Post. So this notion that he arrived in Iraq and the first thing he did was obtain everything and dump everything, is completely false.
You're a blogger for The Nation. You were former editor at Editor and Publisher, the magazine that covers the newspaper industry. What concerns do you have about the implications of this case on investigative journalism in the future?
Well, that was why there was so much focus by the media, which largely ignored this trial. But they did focus on the thing that threatened them the most, which was that if the aiding the enemy charge had been confirmed, which would have had a chilling effect not only on whistleblowers but also on the media, because people may have written articles that ended up, allegedly having some benefit or ending up in the hands or helping to motivate some enemy abroad in some unforeseen way, and that they could end up on this very, very serious charge themselves. Whistleblowers of all types, and certainly media of all types. So the media was concerned that their own members would suffer because of that. So that's why you saw so much focus on that angle.
David Rifkin, back to you. If, in fact, Greg Mitchell says Mr. Manning or Private Manning was, in fact, somewhat selective at least, he wasn't as selective as Edward Snowden. Should Snowden be treated more leniently, do you think, than Bradley Manning?
Well, I mean, the way things work in the criminal prosecution area, if you committed a grave enough offense, the fact that it may be half as grave, if you're killed, five people in your mass murder and somebody else killed 40 does not mean that you deserve half punishment. The real question is the gravity of your offense commensurate with a particular charge being applied? So I don't, it's as obvious to your listeners.
You wouldn't make a distinction between the two then?
I would not make much of a distinction. But again, one thing I would say that we have, and this is you very adroitly asked about the harm to reporters. But let me also say about another harm. We now have, in short order, two individuals who manifest again total disdain for what you do with classified information, who have leaked vast quantities of information, very much so with Manning, whether it's all of it or half of it, really does not make a difference to me, with Snowden yet to be seen. And they're seriously suggesting that they've done it for idealistic reasons because of, you know, horrible abuses of privacy, war crimes, etc. Use your labels. And they're being applauded. I frankly despair when I hear that, and I know it's a big word, because this is not a healthy situation for our republic. We're supposed to have respect for the rule of law. We're supposed to believe it, by and large, despite individual mistakes, the people's representatives of both Congress and the executive branch are doing the right thing. And this is this to me is the real dysfunction and the real consequence of this phenomenon, where they're literally being lauded as heroes and somebody will go down in history. I think it's wrong.
Jocelyn Raddick, you were with the Justice Department. You were a whistleblower there. You now represent whistleblowers in a court. What do you say about Mr. Rifkin and his concept of operating according to the rule of law?
Well, I think the reality is totally different. The facts are totally different. Neither myself nor Bradley Manning nor Edward Snowden were out for fame or profit or self-aggrandizement or had inflated egos. In fact, we all leaked anonymously, specifically so the media would focus on rather than the messenger. Pardon?
Didn't Snowden identify himself pretty early on?
Eventually he did, and eventually I did, and eventually Bradley Manning did at different points once we were all under the microscope of criminal prosecution. But in terms of people having total disdain for how you deal with classified information, I would argue that the government has total disdain for the populace by hiding in secret illegal activities, in Snowden's case, that clearly violate FISA and Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And in Manning's case, you would have to tease out more the specific laws and link them up with different things that he revealed, but clearly evidenced numerous illegalities. And this puts a huge chill on whistleblowing, as if we're not in the deep freeze already by the war on whistleblowers and the attacks on journalists to whom they disclose information.
Okay, quickly, Greg Mitchell, are you concerned about that?
Well, of course. I mean, I've written about whistleblowers for over 30 years of all sorts of different stripes, so it's a major concern, and there certainly is crackdowns on whistleblowers under the Obama administration, I think the media has to be concerned about that because they are so often the sources for media stories. So it's a public issue, it's a media issue, and it's something we should all be concerned about in the years ahead.
Elizabeth Goitein at the Brennan Center for Justice, what sentences do you anticipate, given what the judge found Private Manning to be guilty of?
Well, at the sentencing phase, the issues that the judge will be considering are actually much broader than what he was found guilty of, and even some of the things that were found irrelevant at the guilt phase are going to be relevant at the sentencing phase, such as Bradley Manning's motive and such as whether harm was actually caused by his disclosure. And on that, I just need to say one thing in response to what David was saying. I just want to just read a very quick quote.
Very quickly, because we're out of time, essentially.
Okay. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates at the time was talking about the disclosures. He said, is this embarrassing? Yes. Is it awkward? Yes. Consequences for U.S. foreign policy? I think fairly modest. So that's what the Secretary of Defense said. I think we have to take him at his word.
Okay. I'm sorry we don't have time to give David Rifkin an opportunity to respond to that, but I want to thank all of you for being on our program. Again, Elizabeth Goitein is with the Brennan Center. Mr. Rifkin is formerly with the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations in the Justice Department and the White House. Greg Mitchell blogs for The Nation. His book is called Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. Jocelyn Raddick is Director of National Security and Human Rights at the Government Accountability Project, which advocates for whistleblowers. She is a whistleblower herself. Thank you all very much for being on our program. There's going to be much more to talk about with regard to this case, obviously, in the days to come, and we'll follow up with all of you. Thank you again for being with us today. When NPR's Weekend Edition host Scott Simon began tweeting about his mother's process of dying, his messages were shared by a wider and wider audience on talk shows and magazines and elsewhere on the Internet. What is the broader message about Americans' ability to share our grief? Change of pace for us on To The Point. We'll be back with that in a moment.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q. KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/theq.
Foreman, only back with today's talking point. Here's one of Scott Simon's tweet. But as my mother said, the nice thing about being a Chicagoan is she'll continue to be able to vote on Election Day. Scott Simon's mother could make jokes even as she was dying. And finally, there was this message. You wake up and realize you weren't dreaming. It happened. Cry like you couldn't last night. Confirmation of a death that a very large number of people had come to anticipate because of the way that Scott Simon's tweets were picked up by other organizations and spread. Here to talk about that, Megan O'Rourke, essayist, poet, most recent book, The Long Goodbye, which she calls an account of mourning in America. She joins us from the Harborfront Inn in Greenport on Long Island. Megan O'Rourke, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the importance of this, do you think? Scott Simon, a semi-celebrity, a lot of people have called him, with a million and a half Twitter listener or Twitter partners, much amplified because of this extraordinary thing of tweeting day after day as his mother was dying.
Well, I think that the extraordinary response to his tweets shows that Americans are hungry for a more meaningful way to integrate death and mourning into our daily lives. You know, we live in this culture which has a kind of hurry up and get over it approach to death and to mourning, where, you know, death has become a very private experience and it happens in hospitals far from our friends and our workplace. And as sympathetic as we all want to be to other people, it's just become a very private experience instead of a reminder of the fact that it is the experience that we all share.
Are we, despite that obvious fact, then the one fact that's certain about life, are we in denial?
I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in my book, The Long Goodbye, I talk about the fact that over the course of the 20th century in the West in particular, we've really silenced death. You know, we are in denial about it. It's for good reasons, right? It's a terrible thing to contemplate. It's heart-wrenching to watch our loved ones die, as Simon's tweets, you know, so deeply capture. So yeah, we're in denial about that. But the question is that denial helping us or hurting us? And I think the response to his tweet suggests that there's this, you know, again, hunger for connection.
They were very intimate in many ways. Some people found them to be poetic. Others said he was being self-important. He made himself vulnerable to that charge, I suppose. What's your take on it?
Well, you know, there's always going to be someone out there who's a critic, right? I thought his tweets were very, very powerful, and for two reasons. And I think social media is a really important part of how we deal with death today for two reasons. One is that something like Twitter captures the immediacy of death. And one of the incredibly surreal, strange things about it is the way that death totally ruptures our experience of time, both our experience of time with loved ones and our own personal experience of time. And that kind of, you know, as you say, very obvious and yet somehow repressed realization that, you know, one day this is going to come to an end. And his tweets, I thought, you know, really captured all of the kind of strangenesses of dying today, dying in a hospital, the kind of bureaucracy of the hospital. And then, you know, his mother is a wonderful character in them, and, you know, talking about things like the small pleasures of flossing and how she's going to miss that. So I found them extremely moving, and I actually thought that the format of Twitter, which restricts you to 140 characters, was part of their intensity, right? That brevity reminded us of the brevity of our lives, too.
Is this something that everybody can do or that everybody ought to try to do?
You know, I don't want to be prescriptive about it or not. I think certainly, as anyone who read Scott Simon's tweets and responded to them, might have felt he really did it with a lot of kind of intensity and beauty. And again, I thought his mother's voice came through so powerfully. She seemed such a character. I'm not sure everyone's tweets would be quite as, you know, lyrical and punchy, but I do think that Twitter and Facebook in the 21st century have become part of our way of trying to recover a kind of public mourning ritual. You know, that for hundreds of years across countries and cultures, private grief and public mourning always went hand in hand, right? So your mother died and the village would come to your door kind of bringing soups and sitting shiva, you know, sitting with you for the wake. And we don't have that in quite the same way anymore. And I think that what we're seeing is, you know, on his part and on the part of the many other users who do this, is a kind of attempt to have a that kind of public mourning ritual.
Why do we need that? Is it a way of imposing our problems on others?
Well, I, since we all die, I think it's really not that. I think it has to do with the fact that, you know, death brings us in contact with something much, much larger than ourselves and much, much larger than our everyday lives, right? And so I think what we see by looking back at history is that we've always needed this. This has been really important for humans that, you know, we someone dies and we stop to mourn it and to recognize it. So rather than it being an imposition on others, it's a way of kind of creating that shared space, like the space that happens in Kaddish when you go with other people. It's so important in Kaddish that you have other people there to say the prayer with you. And part of the reason for that, and part of what I think is really interesting about this and that most people are probably going to miss, is that it's not so much about him individually. It's about what happens to the collective experience, right? And that right now we have a very psychological experience of death, right? Someone dies and your friends say, how are you? But you don't, as a mourner, necessarily have that space where you're together reflecting on what death means and the ways that witnessing death and being close to death might make us, you know, make different choices or think differently about our own everyday lives.
Your book, The Long Goodbye, was about your own mother's death. Do you wish you had had Twitter?
Well, you know, my book began in a very similar way to this, which is to say it began in real time as columns written on Slate that were published as my mother had just died. And so what I was trying to do is very similar to what he was doing, which is that I was trying to record in real time all of the intensities and rawness of grief without the kind of, you know, after the fact smoothing over or forgetfulness. So in a sense, I wasn't using Twitter, but I was using a kind of blog-like medium on Slate to capture something very similar. And in fact, it wouldn't have existed without that, because I think I would never have felt that book, that anyone wanted to read that book. But honestly, it was the response of readers, you know, to those columns. There's sort of clearly a hunger for a conversation about
Megan O'Rourke. Okay. The book is The Long Goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.